The mother comes first, followed by the children, except Joseph comes before Rachel. And of course, the rabbi said that's because Joseph, who was going to be the hero of the next story, was protecting his mother from the possible attack that Esau would launch as soon as he saw his beautiful mother.
Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company that I met?" Jacob answered, "To find favor with my lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my father. Keep what you have for yourself." Jacob said, "No, please, if I find favor with you, then accept my present from my hand, for truly to see your face is like seeing the face of God, since you have received me with such favor."
Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. Now, I link this to the wrestling match, and this is why I like the possibility that it's really Esau, and this is Jacob's sly way of telling Esau, "I know it was you, but that's okay." Now, Rabbi Gibson, my rabbi at Temple Sinai, doesn't agree with that. He thinks Jacob is being obsequious to the extreme. He's really shoveling it on. He's bowing 7 times. Calling him my lord, and that's a literal translation of the Hebrew, and then seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. Oh my goodness, how wonderful to see you! He thinks he's really laying it on. I like the other possibility better, but either one works. Okay, now what you have here is a stylized interchange. Both of them know that he's going to accept the gift, but they have to go through this ritual. "Oh no, I don't want that." And if you know about the episode, this is somewhat similar to the occasion when Abraham buys the gravesite. There's a stylized exchange about the price, I can't remember the man's name now. The Hittite says, "Oh, my lord, please accept it from me as a gift." And Abraham says, no, I want to pay full price." No, you accept it. It's my gift to you." But they both know that Abraham's going to pay for it. So they know what's going to happen here. But they're observing the niceties. They're observing the formalities. And by accepting the present, Esau is saying, "Okay, it's like burying the hatchet." He is saying, "Okay, I accept you back, and we will not have the I won't try to kill you anymore, like I said I was going to." Would somebody else like to pick up the reading? Please. Seir.
So Esau said, "Let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "Why should my lord be so kind to me?" So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house and made booths for his cattle. Therefore, the place is called Succoth.
And a sukkah in Hebrew is a booth. There's a holiday, a fall holiday, the holiday of ingathering, the one that the pilgrims use Thanksgiving as the model for Thanksgiving. That's in the fall, and the holiday is called Sukkot because we build booths, temporary structures, which remind us both of the of the wanderings in the wilderness, the 40 years, and in the harvest time, people build booths to remain in the fields during the harvest so they wouldn't have to walk back and forth twice a day, waste all that time. So Sukkot means booths. Yeah.
What's the point of this exchange where Esau says, I'll leave my men, and Jacob says, no, and then Jacob goes, instead of following Esau, goes off somewhere else.
Okay. What's that all about? Excellent. That's the question I was going to ask. So why do you think he's doing this? What is this exchange about? Jacob wants to settle things with his brother. He doesn't want to be under constant threat of attack, but he doesn't want to get too close. Esau is not the kind of person, he doesn't want to join together with Esau to become one family. Esau does have significant flaws, and he knows that he is the one who will continue the covenant of Abraham, because God told him that. God told him that twice. I'm sorry, not yet. God told him that once. We'll get to the second time in a moment. So he wants to be reconciled with his brother, but he doesn't want to be physically close to him. So every attempt that Esau makes to bind them closer together, he kind of rejects. And Esau, I'm sure, understands what's going on. This is like, we must have lunch. Well, I'll have your people call my people. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. The only record that we ever have of them having other contact is when they come together to bury their father, Isaac. So, they reconcile, but then they separate. Esau goes back to Seir, which is on the east side of the Jordan River, in what's now Jordan. And Jacob goes on to Sukkot, which is on the west side of the Jordan, which is in what's now, probably the West Bank, but on the Israel side. Okay, would you like to continue? To one more, finish up the chapter. I'm sorry?
Why is he still being called Jacob if it's his real name? What's the...
We haven't used his real name yet. We haven't used his name Israel yet. He's been Jacob even after he got the name. But who did he get the name from?
His God.
Well, maybe or maybe not. You know, and it could be, thinking about him, Jacob, as a person, he may be still wondering or trying to get comfortable in his new skin. But the fact that he is called Jacob is maybe significant. It may not be. But and there's a question, I guess, as to whether he's really being truthful with his brother. If you subscribe to the possibility that the name Jacob is used when it's his lower self, then that could be why it's used here. He's not being truthful with his brother. They both know what's going on, but he's not saying it. So that could be a possibility. So please, let's continue. Shechem. Hamor.
Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the plot of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El
Elohe Yisrael. Here the name is used. El is God. Elohe is the construct, God of. So it's El, God of Israel. The first time his new name is actually used, and he uses it to build an altar. Now we come to a very disturbing episode. Yeah, I want to make sure we have enough time. This is the story of Dinah. Now I have to remember that Dinah was the only daughter that we're told about. She's the daughter of Leah. For those of you who have read or seen The Red Tent, this is the story that's based on. So we'll go through it quickly, because usually the story is about Dinah, but since we're talking about Jacob, we'll look at his part of it. Would somebody like to read? Please.
Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women.
Now, here's the first problem that we have. She went out to visit the daughters of the land. What was she doing going out to visit the daughters of the land? This was not done. A woman would not go out by herself in this society. Think today of what we read about of the societies of the Middle East, Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. A woman going out by herself is asking for trouble. We don't agree with that, of course, but in those times it was a problem. So it's left. So we need to wonder about what Dinah's motives were, and why she would go out by herself. But she's exposing herself to danger. Women were protected first by their fathers, and then by their husbands. Physically and financially, they were protected. She is leaving that protection by going out by herself.
Prince of the region saw her, he seized her and lay with her by the coats, and his soul was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Jacob spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl to be my wife."
Okay, so Shechem, I'm sorry, Shechem, the prince, sees her, rapes her, and then falls in love with her. And it says he spoke tenderly. The Hebrew literally says spoke to her heart. So he asks his father to pay the bride price to get her for him as a wife. I'm sorry, did somebody say?
How does Hamor fit into this? How does the chief of the
region? We'll see in a moment. He'll be part of the negotiations.
Okay.
Now Jacob heard that Shechem had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his cattle in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they.
His daughter is raped, and what does he do? Nothing. This is the guy who was so active in his dealings with Laban. This is the guy who was so active in trying to get ahead of his brother in his early life. And he's reduced to silence. He waits for his sons to get home. This is the man who has been injured by his struggle with the adversary. And the injury apparently is more than just physical.
Present and gift desires you like, and I will give whatever you ask me. Only give me the girl to be my wife.
Okay, so Hamor, as the father, takes the lead in bargaining for his son's wife. That's his role. He agrees and he presents this, but then Shechem steps up and says, "Oh, I'll pay you anything you want." And I'm sure his father is staying there. What's the matter with you? I don't want to. I mean, this Rabbi Gibson tells the story of how they were in the Shuk in Jerusalem, and his wife is bargaining for a tablecloth. And she really likes to bargain. Of course, that's the norm in that situation. And he walks in as the negotiation is going on, and the storekeeper says, "Oh, what do you think about this thing for 500 shekels?" And she says, "Oh, it's wonderful." And she almost kicked him because she's trying to get it for 300 shekels. So the son steps up and he just ruins the negotiation. "Whatever you want, I will pay." Please continue.
The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, that you will become as we are, and every male among you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live among you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughters and be gone."
Okay, so there's no financial negotiations. Notice that this is the brothers talking. This is Jacob's sons. Jacob is nowhere to be found in this negotiation, where it should be him dealing with Hamor. On both sides, the children have taken over the negotiations, which is not the normal way in this society. Okay. Would somebody else like to pick up?
Their proposal seemed good to Hamor and his son Shechem. The young man, who was the most honored of all his father's household, lost no time in doing what they said, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So Hamor and his son Shechem went to the gate of their city to speak to their fellow townsmen. "These men are friendly toward us," they said. "Let them live in our land and trade with them. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. But the people will consent to live with us, one people only, on the condition that our males be circumcised, as they themselves are. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their animals become ours? So let us give our consent, and they will settle with us." All the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised.
Okay, so now notice how Hamor and Shechem changed the message. When they were talking to Jacob and his family, they said, "The land will be open before you, and you can move about and acquire holdings in it." When they're talking to their own people, they're saying, "Aha, we'll absorb them. Everything they have will become ours." The political message they're giving to their own people is different from the negotiations with Jacob's sons. Please.
3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male. They put Hamor and his sons Shechem to the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks, their herds and donkeys, and everything else of theirs in the city and out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the house.
Okay.
And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi.
All right, let's stop here for a moment. For two things. First, it's Shimon and Levi, who are doing this. They're two of the full brothers of Dinah, but it's only them. little bit strange. Shimon kind of disappears in terms of the hierarchy, but Levi, he's the tribe of Levi become the priests, the Levites, which is kind of a strange connotation that they're involved in this. What they have done, the thing that bothers me about what they've done is something we haven't talked about here because it goes back to the earlier parts. Circumcision is a sign of the covenant. It was commanded by God of Abraham. They are using, the brothers, are using circumcision, the sign of the covenant, as a ruse to disable the men so they can kill them all. This is problematic to say the least. So what they have done now in certain societies, the trickster, the coyote, is looked upon with favor. He's the one who always gets ahead. But not in this context. So please finish the story.
Then Jacob said to Simeon, "You have brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the people living in this land. We are few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed." But they replied, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?"
Okay. So what's Jacob's response?
"You're going to come and get me.
You've made me vulnerable." Nothing about the morality of it. I'm sorry?
It's all about me.
Yes, in a sense that why do these bad things always happen to me? Look what you've done to me. And what's their response? This is a matter of honor. And we see echoes of that today in some countries of the Middle East. Now, what are we missing in this whole story? I'm sorry?
Rachel.
Well, Rachel, yeah, no, she's right. She's not literally really a part of this story.
Leah,
but what are we missing in this? Anita Diamant made a whole book out of this. We're missing Dina's feelings in this whole matter. She was raped, but then it said he spoke to her heart. If you read or saw the Red Tent, Anita Diamant makes it kind of like a mutual attraction. They saw each other in the marketplace, and they were kind of attracted to each other, and they looked coyly at each other. So maybe it wasn't so bad. And maybe she really wanted the marriage to occur. Nobody asked her anything. The brothers stormed the palace, took her, and went away. But since our focus is Jacob, we can see that, again, his behavior is problematic. But it's problematic on the negative side in that he doesn't do anything. He's reduced to impotence, and his sons take over. So he's worried about being attacked. So would somebody else like to pick up? Right. So God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and remain there and build an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Rid yourselves of the alien gods in your midst. Purify yourselves and change your clothes." Apparently, others of the household had gods with them. Only the members of the family were expected to be, well, even at this point, they weren't monotheists, but their primary allegiance was to be to the God of Abraham. "Come, let us go up to Bethel, and I will build an altar there to the God who answered me when I was in distress, who has been with me wherever I have gone." They gave to Jacob all the alien gods that they had and the rings that were in their ears, and Jacob buried them under the terebinth that was near Shechem. As they set out, a terror from God fell on the cities round about, so they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So again, God protects Jacob and Jacob's family. Thus Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. There he built an altar and named the site El Bethel. El is God again, Bethel is house of God. For it was there that God had revealed God's self to him when he was fleeing from his brother. Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oak below Bethel, so it was named Alon Bakuth. I cannot find any purpose for that little insert. We never heard about Deborah before, and we never hear about her again. But here we come to a key part of the of this portion. Somebody else, please. Who will read?
I'll read.
Please.
Start at chapter 9, or verse 9. God appeared to Jacob again when he was in the Petaram, and he blessed him. God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall be you be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he was called Israel.
Now, the Hebrew is a little bit better, is a little bit more direct. Thus, he named him Israel. So who names him Israel this time? God directly names the, and you could say either God confirms or God establishes the name, if you don't think it was God who wrestled with him in the first place, but God gives him the name. It is now firmly established. Please, go ahead. Please, continue.
So he called, God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall spring from you. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you." Then God went up to him at the place where he had spoken with him. Jacob set up a pillar on the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. He poured out a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. So Jacob called the place where God had spoken with him at that.
Okay. And again, we notice that even though it's God who's given him the name now, it's still Jacob doing all these things. But the critical point here now is that God reaffirms, after all of these things, after 20 years have passed, that Jacob is the one who will receive the covenant, who will carry on the covenant.
Yeah, that's problematic to me. Why does he do that?
Why Jacob?
Why does God bless Jacob?
Okay. Well, and I want to that's where we'll end up the series, because I do want to spend some time discussing that. And we'll talk about the positives and negatives. So hang on to that for just a few minutes. But I want to make sure we get this last part in. Okay, please continue. One more paragraph.
Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when they were still some distance from the Ephrath, Rachel was in childbirth, and she had hard labor. When she was in her hard labor, the midwife said to her, "Do not be afraid, for now you will have another son." As her soul was departing, for she died, she named him Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar at her grave. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Peter.
Okay. Migdal Eder, mound of witness. Rachel dies in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin. And of course, why does she die in childbirth?
It goes back to the time when Jacob talked about the gods that
Jacob said,
from
who?
Laban, and who, said, if you find somebody among my camp who has them, they shall be put to death.
Well, he said, whoever has the gods will die. And there's a very strong link here that the author is trying to give us, I think, between our actions and the consequences. Jacob let his words get the best of him, let his emotions get the best of him. She didn't die immediately, but she died in a way that was unique among his whole family. And Rachel's tomb is still there in the West. It's in the West Bank today. And it's a point of great contention between the Israelites and the Israelis and the Palestinians. A long time ago, a Jew named Baruch Goldstein massacred some Arabs at prayer. You may remember that. That was a long time ago. It was at the site of Rachel's tomb. Rachel's tomb is still a place of pilgrimage for women who are looking for fertility. Ben-Oni, the name that she gives the child, means son of my affliction, which says volumes about the way she has viewed her life. Jacob changes the name to Ben-Yamin. Yamin is right, the son of my right hand, which is the symbol of strength. So he doesn't want the child to go through life with that terrible name, and names him Benjamin. So now, one more. We're going to skip, do a couple of things here. Look at verse 27. Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre at Kiriat Arba, now Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Isaac was 180 years old when he breathed his last and died. He was gathered to his kin in ripe old age, and he was buried by his sons Esau and Jacob. How did this whole story start? Do you remember? Isaac called his son Esau and said to him, I'm about to die. Go out and hunt me some game so that I may give you my innermost blessing. We don't know what ages the kids were when that started or what they are now, but it's at least 20 years that Jacob spent in Padan Aram. Isaac wasn't as close to death as he thought he was, because he was still alive long after all of these events happened. And perhaps there's a message here that by trying to force God's hand, we create many more difficulties for ourselves than we would have otherwise. All of this could have been unnecessary had people let God's plan unfold. The last thing we need to talk about is in chapter 47, verse 7. This happens after Joseph has been sold into slavery in Egypt. Joseph torments his brothers. Eventually they reconcile, or they reconcile. That's okay. Joseph brings his father Jacob and all his brothers down to Egypt. And Joseph then brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. And Jacob greeted Pharaoh. Actually, the Hebrew says Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh asked Jacob, "How many are the years of your life?" And Jacob answered Pharaoh, "The years of my sojourn on earth are 130. Few and hard have been the years of my life, nor do they come up to the lifespans of my fathers during their sojourns. Then Jacob bade Pharaoh farewell, again says he blessed him, and left Pharaoh's presence. Jacob's summary of his own life. I don't know. Maybe you can tell me how you describe it. It's a rather depressing view. After all that he's been through, few and evil. The Hebrew word is ra, which is often used as evil. Few and evil have been the days of my life. What more tragic end could you think of for somebody to assess his life in that way? We certainly wouldn't want to do that. But that's the way he sees his life at the end. Of course, at this point, he's been through all the whole Joseph story, and he may or may not know what his sons did to him, but it's not a happy ending. So, the gentleman who was in the back left, but he wanted to talk about his question. Yes.
But at the end of his life, he's still Jacob.
Yes. He never lost the Jacob part of his life. And it goes back and forth. But it's the Israel part that continues, because we consider ourselves the sons of the B'nai Yisrael. Jacob continues to be used. Even the prophets continue to use Jacob, not just Israel. So both are there, and there's that struggling aspect that continues. So, why does God continue to favor Jacob? After all that we've seen that he's done, he cheated his brother, lied to his father, stole the blessing, was cheated by and cheated Laban, stood silent while his sons murdered the people of Shechem, even though it was only Shechem who committed the crime. Why Jacob? Why is he still? Why does God still favor him? Even at the end of all of this, we just read that. Even after all the 20 years, God says, "You are the one that I will use to establish, to continue my covenant."
Who else was there?
God is God. God Isaac was still alive. Could have had another son. Yeah?
I'm
and to be honest, to some degree I am too. And it's always dangerous to ask why God does things. God is completely, in my view, God is completely incomprehensible. Trying to say God is with us is hubris to the extreme. You're the right age. You probably remember Bob Dylan's song, "With God on Our Side." It's one of the most dangerous statements that we can make. So many people have died because God was on our side. And yet, we need to ask, why? Why Jacob? And the only thing I can find, and this is a theme that I see throughout the Bible, God doesn't give up on Jacob because Jacob never gives up on God. Throughout his experiences, Jacob continually attributes his success to God. He never says it was because of my excellence, because I'm so smart, because I'm so brave, because I'm so strong. At every step in the way where it comes up, he attributes his success to God. And to some degree, Joseph is the same way, but that's the next generation. But the theme it seems to me that's one of the major themes of the Bible. That there are very few things you can do where you can't, that will destroy your relationship to God if you choose to continue it. Even David, who committed murder, was able to maintain his relationship with God because he maintained the relationship. He called upon God. When God spoke to him, he responded. When Nathan came to him and said with the parable about the rich man stealing the sheep, and because he had taken Bathsheba from Uriah the Hittite, and Nathan points the finger and David says, that person should be killed, and Nathan points the finger at him and says, that person is you? Instead of having Nathan killed, he says, you're right, and he repents. Now, in the Jewish view, murder is one of the one sin that you can never truly repent for, because the person you injured is no longer around to give you forgiveness. But even that, he was able to maintain a relationship with God. And Jacob shows the same quality. He sees himself in relation to God. That's the way he sees the world. And that in itself may be what he needs for God to respond. In each turning point in the Jewish people's history that's recorded in the Bible, God wants people to make the first step. When God appears to Moses in the burning bush, God doesn't speak to Moses until after Moses has turned aside. Moses said, I must turn aside to see this great sight. Why does the bush burn as not consumed? Only then will God speak to Moses. The Passover holiday that we're about to come to next Sunday, Friday night, leading up to Easter, in your church. The story says that God commanded through Moses that the Israelites sacrifice the goat as an offering and put the blood on the lintel of the doorposts. Why? Doesn't God know who the Israelites are? The purpose could be that God wants us to stand up and make a statement. We have to say, from my viewpoint, that I am one of the people, and I am doing what God told me to do. And if you don't do that, then the angel of death is free to come in and kill your firstborn son. We need to step up first. And then when we take the first action, then God responds. And that happens continually. So Jacob, despite his failings, is in that kind of a relationship with God. If we see ourselves in that relationship, God will respond to us. May not always be in the way we want, because God is God, and we can't control God, but God does respond. That's the message of the Bible. Anything else, please? Questions, comments?
Was God's covenant with Israel mm-hmm. as a man, or Israel as a nation?
Yes. Yes. Jacob Israel as the patriarch, he is the founder of the people, and we take his name. So there's no real distinction between the two. He is us. And when we have the Seder every year, we're reestablishing that connection. Not only the Seder, but all the holidays. We're reestablishing the connection with our ancestors. We're reliving history today. And we recall the B'nai Yisrael, the Israelites.
In our country, we think of ourselves as Americans, individuals. We also think of the nation. And somehow the nation is something greater than any one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess people are inspired by thinking we're Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't think of any one American who is great enough to reflect the whole nation. Maybe Lincoln or something. But Jacob did not reflect the greatness of the whole of Israel. There's no... This is difficult. He's an individual,
He's an individual, and he's a flawed individual, as were the other patriarchs.
Then does the whole nation of Israel tarnish?
Of course, because we're human, and we're always going to mess up. The whole book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, basically, is one failure after another of the people to listen to God. They're confronted by the miracles. They experience them, and yet they still complain. Oh, we're so tired of this manna. We need meat. Why did you take us out into the wilderness? It would have been better for us to serve Israel, to serve Egypt, and be comfortable.
You wonder why God wouldn't just get rid of all of us.
Absolutely. Because, and I think I may have talked about this in the first lecture, because, and it goes on today, God maintains the covenant because of zechut avot, the merits of the ancestors. Because of what Abraham and Isaac and Jacob did in establishing the relationship, that's the reason that we still see that we're part of that covenant today. It is because of them, not because of us who live today. And as we've seen, there are negative aspects too, but we learn from the negatives as well as from the positives. But we are here not because we Jews are here, not because of our own merits, but because of zechut avot, the merits of our ancestors.
Which ancestors?
These, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
But wasn't the covenant really, the covenant was that their ancestors would be fruitful and multiply and God would bless them. So that was the covenant.
Right.
That you would be the people.
Right. We are the recipients of the covenant.
Yeah.
But we are not, it's not correct to say that the covenant still exists because of our own merits.
Well, that was the promise that God made.
Right. But it's because it's the merit of Abraham, the merit of Isaac, and the merit of Jacob that we continue today. Not because of our own excellence.
I just thought of something. Does America,
I'm sorry?
Does America also go on today because of the people who started way back when?
We can certainly make an analogy to that. And certainly our founding fathers were well-versed in the Hebrew Bible. They knew all of that. And certainly you could draw that parallel, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that America is such a great country because God is on our side. If we do the right thing, then God will be on our side. If we don't, then you can't make that statement. Everything we do is not right because God is on our side.
Is that true of Israel?
Yes. And of the country of Israel today. There's no question that that there are many problematic things to go on over there. Israel is the country of Israel, not even speaking about Jews outside of Israel, but the country of Israel is as close to a true democracy as you're going to get anywhere in the world, and they are having, you just saw these elections, the strong conflicts. This is an ongoing debate that they're trying to figure out who they are, just as we try to figure out who we are every 4 years. It doesn't always get clearer. How about that? Perfect timing. Thank you to Peter for recommending me. Thank you for I thank the church for inviting me, and I thank you all for being with me. I really enjoy this, and I think you have been a wonderful study partners with me. I've really enjoyed the time here, and I hope we can do it again sometime. But thank you very much for the opportunity to do this.